A century ago, the first International Women's Day event was held. So this week's Spirit of Things is dedicated to Claire of Assisi, the 12th century woman who ventured out to establish the Sister Order of the Franciscans. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. You're tuned to ABC Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn. You might be wondering if Claire and Francis of Assisi were sweethearts, you know, like Heloise and Abelard a century before, who had a forbidden but passionate affair. In fact, a famous French biography of St. Francis suggests as much, but it was a romantic fiction. In all of the writings of Francis, he never mentions Claire. Yet he's the inspiration for the Order of Poor Ladies, which Claire established. Indeed, there's written evidence that in the beginning, men and women lived the same life according to the same monastic ideal, but soon the women were secluded at San Damiano under Claire's leadership. Francis died in 1226 at the age of 44, and Claire died aged 59 in 1253. Both had remarkable lives and would be canonized 2 years after their death. But it's Francis who's most remembered. Perhaps his friars had something to do with the cloak of silence around Claire. A new book called Interpreting Francis and Claire of Assisi reconsiders their lives and legacy, and I spoke to the editors, Claire Rankin and Constant Muse, in Melbourne. Constant Muse, Claire Rankin, it's good to have you on The Spirit of Things. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, saints are sometimes popular and sometimes they're not, Constant. I suppose over the centuries it would depend on which pope is in power or which order was dominant. Did Francis's star wax and wane?
I think Francis is a special case among the saints. You're quite right that many saints do have their moments of glory and then they fade, rather. I think it's one of the most extraordinary features of Francis that he has always resurfaced and spoke with a new clarity to a new generation. It's something which makes him different, I think, from many other saints. For example, his great contemporary was Dominic, St. Dominic. But Francis has a charisma which I think always appeal to people who are just slightly offside with the establishment and allowed people to reconnect. And the phrase they used about Francis was in Latin, alter Christus, another Christ, that no other figure in Christian history has attracted quite that sort of phrase. So I think he speaks in every way, to people who are sometimes quite outside the establishment.
Well, could the same be said about Claire? I mean, I've always thought Claire played second fiddle to St. Francis. Claire, what, and this is confusing because you're also called Claire,
also Claire,
aren't you?
Yes, in fact, my second name is Francis, so that makes it even more confusing.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Claire, what about Claire?
I think Claire is a different category because, first of all, in her own eyes, in her own writing, she speaks of herself as being the little plant, which on first hearing or first reading tends to suggest that she is the fruit or she is the result of Francis' initiative. And I think in some ways that understanding was fostered, certainly to some degree, by Francis' successors, the friars, who in fact, one could say, wished totally to forget Claire. So from their perspective, I think she certainly had a less than important role. However, for her own women, and I think also for other women successively historically, they have found in her a most remarkable figure, a most inspiring figure, who despite perhaps more periods of less importance historically, she has always become a figure who women especially, and I think members of the Franciscan movement, including of course women, but also men, have found an avenue to take them back to not only Francis's original vision, but also I think the original vision of the gospel.
Well, this book that you have both edited on Francis and Claire, does it reflect this burgeoning interest in both of them, or is it an attempt to revive an interest in them?
Well, let me start, if I may, and Claire may follow. But the first idea that I had was Claire, this Claire, told me what I didn't realise. It was the 800th anniversary in 2009 of the founding of the Order. And so my immediate thought was interpreting Francis of Assisi. What a wonderful figure. But it was really the discovery of so much significant work going on by people here in Australia, often women, scholars and practicing religious, which said we actually had to rethink our mission. Mm. And it changed to interpreting Francis and Claire of Assisi.
No, I think that's right. I think I found that especially in talking to religious women, especially women who claim a Franciscan or a Francis and Claire historical association, they find that in the work that's been done, and I think a lot of the work of going back to the origins, which of course was inspired by Vatican II for religious orders, it's forced them to go back to the original documents and to discover that in fact the relationship between Francis and Claire, indeed, you cannot really think about Francis if you want to understand Francis, and if you want to find an expression of his life that was probably lived to its most authentic and with greatest integrity, then you have to look at Claire, because in a sense, she's the figure who most authentically, and perhaps one can say most successfully, pursued his vision of living a life of poverty and a life of seeking to identify totally with Christ, the gospel life.
Well, let's look at what Francis's vision was. But before we do that, a bit about him. I mean, over the years, I've done programs on Francis, and it's always a wonderful story to talk about his origins. So, Constant, can you just give us a kind of thumbnail sketch about where he came from?
Well, he comes from Assisi. He's born in the late 12th century. And his father is a merchant who travels a lot to France. And to understand Francis, I think it's interesting to think about the time as one of great and growing affluence, so that this was very much a mercantile society where money in people's lifetime had become so much more important. It was literally captivating people in a way that they had not seen before. And I think Francis certainly is the son of a wealthy man. Claire is of a noble family. She's of a different class. But Francis is somebody who is doing, when he's young, he does what many young men did, which was, you know, fight in the local wars. There was incessant quarrelling between these towns. And it was very much, life was about one-upmanship. And Francis's decision to abandon the world in some ways was traditional. It would have been perfectly normal for him to decide, I don't like this lifestyle of being a son of a merchant, I'm going to go to a monastery. What is so important is that he steers completely away from that option. And he tells us that the experience which actually shocked him and transformed him was meeting a leper. These lepers, they may just have had some physical gross deformity, it may not be modern leprosy, but they were people who were the physically isolated from society. And he tells us that he was so overwhelmed by this encounter with a leper that he realized that this was where Christ was leading him and, in fact, was speaking to him. And we have a celebrated story how he confronts his father and decides in the full marketplace to take off his clothes and gives them to the poor. Now, there was a certain precedent for this. Martin of Tours divides his cloak in two. But Francis decides to abandon his life in public. And I think what is so important at this time is to understand there was many people who were completely disillusioned with the established church. We call them heretics, or they were people who had simply drifted away from the church, which was seen as being so wealthy, corrupt, and out of touch. Francis was unusual in that rather than just going into a simple anti-clericalism, which was very common at the time, just as common as it is now, nothing modern about being anti-clerical, but Francis always remains a layperson. He decides to re-establish the church.
Well, it's interesting because you have focused on him as a man of practical theology, a practical vision. Now, I wonder whether this was in any way against the trend of the time, which would have seen Thomas Aquinas and his philosophical theology be given a great deal of regard and importance. So was he forging a consciously different path from that?
Yes, Francis never went to university. In fact, he could have. I mean, if he was from he was from a bright family. I suspect he probably was a very intelligent man. But, and this was so important, he never put himself in the clerical class. Interesting to compare him with Dominic. Dominic Guzman was a cleric who had this great vision of the need to reform the clerical order and establishes what he called the order of preachers. But what Francis sees as important is let's create an order of, in English, lesser brothers. Friars Minor is the Latin word. That label is so unusual. It was really making a point of their modesty and that these were brothers. These weren't even priests. In fact, they did start ordaining people, but they wanted to be known as brothers. There were many attempts to kind of go back to the gospel, but Francis realized that it was important to remain faithful to the church in its principles, but not to the practice of its wealth.
Well, is there a tendency, therefore, to see the Franciscans as reactionaries? And is that a fair assessment of them, reactionaries against the sort of faith and reason synthesis which was dominant in Thomas Aquinas' thought?
I think it would be unjust, because an important part of the movement was that while Francis himself was relatively unlettered, he wrote the best Italian poetry, the first major Italian verse was by Francis, but he had a distinct awareness of the need to anchor the gospel in practical situation. Now, what's very interesting is that very soon some very, very bright people said, look, this is where we need to be. And it did not take long for members of the movement to start saying, well, look, we do need to go to university. If we're going to have influence, you have to have education. But what happens is that the style of thought which they develop is interesting because it's always slightly suspicious of learning for its own sake. People who are attracted to somebody like Francis tended to be a little bit, fractious, a little bit independently minded. Bonaventure respected that insight, but he knew that he had to create a community identity. But what he did was to realize, well, he knew this, and this was Francis's message, because the heart of Francis's message was not that the intellect is the most important, it was that love drives everything. Now, there were the Dominican order were committed very much to a task of intellectual reform. They were really committed to engaging in Aristotle, and the abstract questions of the philosophers were of great interest to them and to Thomas Aquinas. Bonaventure is a contemporary of Aquinas. But whereas Aquinas is perhaps privileges the role of intellect in a wonderful, humane way, Bonaventure is interested in the psyche and the love. And perhaps it's for this reason that Bonaventure has an appeal to people outside the academy. And I think that the particular gift of Franciscan thought, that practical aspect, is generated by the fact that you don't need to have a university degree to understand the depth of Franciscan theology. It's got a full intellectual system, behind it. But I think that was the direction in which Bonaventure was pushing.
A 13th century Franciscan song of praise by Jacopone da Todi, suggested by my guest today, Constant Muse, who is the director of the Centre for Studies in Religion and Theology at Monash University, Melbourne. My other guest is Claire Rankin, lecturer in art history and spirituality at Yarra Theological Union in the Melbourne College of Divinity. St. Clare and St. Francis of Assisi are the focus of the Spirit of Things today on ABC Radio National. And as we'll discover, their legacy is huge, including in the arts. Coming up later, we'll plumb the mystery of a Franciscan work of art in the National Gallery of Victoria, which is also celebrating an anniversary of 150 years since its founding. Well, how did the Franciscans answer the question that was certainly afoot during the time of the Renaissance, and there was such a burgeoning of interest in nature, which also led to the beginnings of science and so forth? How did Franciscans answer the question of what God's role was in nature?
The Franciscans and Bonaventure plays a role, an important role in this, have a very strong sense of the divine as immanent in the natural world. This idea was that God has revealed himself through the book of nature. This is a line of thought which had been developed before the time of Francis, but I think it's given a particular significance by the Franciscan writings, because they believe that there is a divine order in this universe which manifests itself in creation, the beauty of creation, and so that there's a strong sense of the aesthetic, not just in what is a beautiful work of art, but that the world itself embodies beauty.
Constant, you've mentioned Dom Scotus, and I want to advert to his work now. I mean, he was one of the key Franciscan thinkers and called the great scholastic doctor, which is quite opposite to Francis's initial almost anti-scholastic push. But he was particularly concerned about the will over the intellect. Now, we've heard of Bonaventure's prioritizing love over the intellect. Now we have the will over the intellect with Dom Scotus. What did he mean by that?
I think that he is looking at psychology in a profound way. The author who really had reflected a lot on the will in Christian thought was Augustine. Augustine had probably become known for what he said about the will, which was the corruption of the will, which was a tendency to sin. And this was something which Augustine developed in later life. There is actually a lot of psychological insight in Augustine, but it tends to be covered by an awareness of sin, which means that you can't quite separate the two when you read Augustine, because his famous phrase was, make me pure, but not yet. You know, that's what he used to say, which was his own issue. I think that what we see with Scotus is that there is a kind of an optimism about human potential, but it's actually recognizing something that we all have the will, and we must exercise the will freely. The Aristotelian system is a very rational system. It's emphasizing that you choose intellectually what is better and you avoid what is wrong. But one could argue, is that really valid for most people? Do they actually choose rationally? Or do you say, well, maybe I just make a choice for the good? And it's in very deep part of the Christian message, and Augustine would have absolutely agreed, that we need to choose the good for whatever reason, whether we're intellectuals or not. But I think that Scotus is somebody who will say, look, the intellect is part of who we are. It's only part. We actually have to make choices. And I think this combines with the sense that let's make a choice for the kingdom of God. And therefore, perhaps is a little bit more dismissive of the people who follow Aristotle, but he has a complete mastery of everything that Aristotle had said. Perhaps he's a greater freedom in the way that he speaks about these intellectual systems.
Well, it seems like what you've been describing there is one of the perennial divides in the world of religion, which is the heart over the mind or the mind over the heart, and the will being the force, the ability to choose one or the other.
I think it's not an issue of just the will, just love, just the intellect. These are all parts of the vision. And I think the other important point to remember in this period, they loved disagreeing with each other. Within the Franciscan order, you had huge differences of opinion. And it wasn't just that the Dominicans all had one opinion either. This is, I think, one of the great things about scholastic thought, which is often seriously misunderstood when people make, you know, a stereotyped assumption about scholasticism, which derives from certain comments made, you know, at the time of the Renaissance, but they weren't actually attacking what scholastic thought could be, which was really one of an incredible set of discussions going on in different communities. Bonaventure, Duns Scotus, Aquinas, they were all offering something. And in fact, one of the things we've been working on is that the Franciscans were picking up from the best things of what St. Thomas had to say. This is something which is perhaps new, a line of thinking. There's a sort of an older stereotype about the Franciscans as not intellectual, the Dominicans were. That's quite false.
Mm.
We've got a much more interesting period.
And your book certainly reveals all of the ways in which the Franciscans developed their theology as well as their practical expressions. And if I can just take you back to that practical theology, how does Christ fit into it?
The Franciscan vision is particularly Christocentric. It is the notion that God is revealed in the life as well as the death of Christ. There has been, sometimes in Christian thought, a tendency to emphasize so much the sacrificial death, the death of Christ on the cross, that, well, as he lived, he preached, but then the church carried that on, so that wasn't so important. What I think the Franciscan contribution is to emphasize the example of Christ in his life as well and his death. This is something which we could also see if we look at art, because we see a shift from the triumphant Byzantine magisterial imperial Christ in victory to an awareness of the weakness and the humanity of Christ on the cross, as well as a figure who lived and breathed and walked among us.
Can I ask you finally if the Franciscan vision, which emphasizes the importance of the human act of loving God, possibly gave birth to a kind of humanism, a Christian humanism, in which there is this assumption that it is within the human capacity to experience God without necessarily being a great intellect?
Absolutely. The movement inspired by Francis and Claire, which has huge repercussions in art, but also in feeling, does shift the agenda of discussion into thinking not just about the intellect and sin, but who we are as human people. And I think it's interesting that there were many men and women who decided not to become members of the order, but wanted to model their lives around Francis and Claire, and the example of holy poverty. Poverty was a shameful condition in contemporary perspective. By insisting on embracing a voluntary poverty, it was something scandalous, and it depended how you practiced it. For some people, it was like tokenistic poverty. For others, it was a very, very real poverty, which was embraced and enforced on people. But whatever your background, I think that the emphasis was on living out an alternative lifestyle. The Franciscan missionaries, I've just been learning about how they went to China in the first 100 years. Unfortunately, that's not in the book, but it's an amazing story of how Franciscans crossed Central Asia. The first Archbishop of Beijing in the 13th century was a Franciscan. There is an extraordinary sense of embracing the world.
Well, Claire, can I ask you about Claire, Saint Claire? Everyone knows about Francis, of course, but probably a lot fewer people know about Claire, less of a mythology perhaps spun around her. But you've said she came from a noble family. I would have imagined that for her to embrace a life of poverty would have been quite a shameful thing.
I think that's exactly right, Rachel. In fact, we know from the sources of Claire's life that the sense of embracing poverty, and not only embracing poverty, but actually, as it were, following a figure like St. Francis, who we remember at the time in the early 13th century when Claire literally left her household. And obviously she had come from a background where she was known for her own, even at the age of 18, extraordinary spiritual life. That Francis had known of this, and whether he approached her directly or through intermediaries, he wished to become known to her. He wished to join her. He wished her to join him. So she left, we're told in the sources, on the evening of Palm Sunday, and she went with him. Now, she left her house, which was, as Constant has told us, she came from a very wealthy aristocratic family. In fact, they lived in quite different parts of Assisi. She lived near the cathedral where the wealthy people lived, where the wealthy aristocrats lived. Francis' family lived where the merchants lived. So by leaving in the middle of the night, and she was leaving as a young woman who, about 18, indisputably, her family intended for her to make an alliance, to marry. So not only was it shameful, the manner in which she left, under cloak of darkness, as you might say, but she was also leaving to throw in her lot, as it were, with a figure who was utterly unknown, who was embarking on this religious adventure, which to us now, in the early 21st century, seems prophetic, but it would not, and it was not, thought of by many of Francis and Claire's compatriots. There were some who believed in and understood, and in fact the Bishop of Assisi was one who did. But such was the fury and anger of her family that we know that very soon after she had left her home and gone with Francis, who then placed her under the care of Benedictine nuns, that her family, probably her father and her uncles, physically tried to remove her from the convent. And in the images, especially the image, there's a Vita panel of her life that's the earliest image of her life that dates to around 1283. And that shows the scene of her where she's taking refuge in the altar of the convent, in the Benedictine convent, and we see her clinging to the altar as the men of her family rush in and attempt to physically remove her.
Very dramatic.
It is. It's the most powerful story, and it says something not only about the clash of values. Here is a daughter who turns her back on everything that her family and her society and class thought was appropriate for her. But it also says something about her formidable will and commitment.
Brother Sun and Sister Moon, I seldom see you, seldom hear your tune.
That music by Donovan is from the 1972 Franco Zeffirelli film Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon, in which Claire and Francis are portrayed as hippies. The latest confection, though purporting to be more historically accurate, is Claire and Francis, produced by Lux Vide and filmed in Italy. You're with The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn, and my guests are the art historian Claire Rankin, who's the co-editor, with Constant Muse, of a fascinating collection of essays called Interpreting Francis and Claire of Assisi, from the Middle Ages to the Present. Well, in recent years here in Melbourne, people would have been able to see marvellous illuminated manuscripts. But you focused your attention on a 15th century illuminated miniature in German, the Clarenbuch, a translation of the life of St. Clare attributed to Thomas of Celano, I imagine.
Yes.
But I'm confused because Clare is considered both the subject and the author of the piece. So who actually wrote it?
The life is considered to have been written now. Most scholars attribute it to Thomas of Celano. However, in the 15th century, and probably even into the 19th century, and Constant, no doubt, would have a better idea about this, it was attributed to Saint Bonaventure. So in that sense, of course, the life is not by Clare. However, the manuscript has a number of other texts included. The substantial section is the life, but there are also five letters, which are letters that it is believed Clare wrote to Agnes of Prague. So in that sense, Clare, of course, is an author. And Clare, of course, more famously, is the author of Her Rule, which is an astounding achievement and is the first time in the Western tradition a religious woman wrote a rule for her own order. So in that sense, perhaps the manuscript is not explicitly, because the rule isn't included in this particular manuscript, but perhaps it's also celebrating her identity as the author, as someone who writes in her voice.
Well, illumination was pretty costly. So who was the Clarenbuch made for? Who would have commissioned it?
The Clarenbuch was made, in this case, it was made as a gift for another Franciscan, or another, I should say, another order of Poor Clares. This was actually not uncommon. And what's wonderful about the manuscript that I was fortunate enough to see and that I have been studying, the illuminator was a member, she was a Poor Clare, Sibylla von Bondorf. And there are over 100 illuminations that are attributed to her. And in fact, she produced or she managed a workshop in two convents or two monasteries where she spent her life as a Poor Clare nun. She not only produced manuscripts for other Poor Clares, she produced manuscripts for Franciscans, for the male branch of the order, and also for other female religious, including an order of women, the Ruhrinnen, which were women who we would perhaps say were repentant women.
Repentant prostitutes, I think.
Exactly, yes.
Well, at least there was life after prostitution.
Oh, more than that. In some senses, it was considered that they had reclaimed their virginity, and that, in fact, virginity was something that could be reclaimed, which strikes us, I think, as a very alien, almost bizarre concept. Mm. But I think it points to a greater flexibility and a greater imaginative understanding of such concepts as virginity. I think we tend to think of virginity purely in terms of a physical state. I think this understanding of virginity and understanding it as something as being perhaps even more powerfully a symbol of a spiritual
state. Yes.
That was foremost.
Well, I'm actually fascinated by the theme that you've discerned in the Clarenbuch, which is the paralleling of Clare with Mary Magdalene, the woman known for her tresses and her expensive balm, which she used to wipe the feet of Jesus. How is this related then to the popular medieval image of the Bride of Christ?
I suspect that probably you've touched on a very important theme. I think it was a very important theme in the late Middle Ages in the image of the Magdalene. And I think it's a theme that we need to perhaps revive or rediscover. I think because of a whole lot of reasons, largely the fact that in contemporary Catholic, especially Catholic scholarship, we have inherited an image of the biblical Mary Magdalene, which until the Reformation was in fact a conflation of three women. Now, in the 19th, 20th century, and of course after Vatican II, with so much of the innovation and returning to sources and the great biblical scholarship, of course Catholic scholars recognised what Protestant scholars, of course, had known since at least the Reformation, that the Magdalene was one woman, and that the conflation was a 6th century conflation, that Gregory the Great, we owe the conflation to Gregory the Great.
And you're talking of the conflation of Mary of Bethany?
Mary, exactly, that's right.
And
Mary of Bethany, the unnamed woman who anoints Christ's feet in Luke's Gospel, and the woman Mary of Magdalene from whom Christ expels seven demons. So Gregory the Great preaches in a very famous sermon in 591 in Rome, and he conflates those figures. So they become the image that we inherited up until perhaps the early 20th century. So I think many biblical scholars, and I think many Catholic biblical scholars and many Catholic women have seized on the realization that Mary Magdalene probably wasn't a sinner. She wasn't the woman who was seen as the woman who was a sinner of the city, and that she's inherited the what we would seem to see as the degrading title of prostitute.
But why was it important then to parallel Claire with Mary Magdalene and this whole notion of being the bride of Christ?
I think the image of the bride of Christ, I think we need to perhaps go back to the image and to see what is evoked by that image. And I think it's an image that has its roots in the imagery of the Song of Songs, the beautiful book of the Old Testament, where that imagery in the earliest years of Christianity, perhaps from the 2nd century and certainly in the 3rd and 4th century, we find the great patristic writers evoke the model of the bride to suggest the image of the church. And so to understand the deep love that Christ possesses for his community, the church, the image that most succinctly and deeply and imaginatively captures that emotion is the love of the bride and the bridegroom. Now, when we then move perhaps to the 12th century to understanding the individual's desire for Christ, we see the image again that's evoked is the image of the bride and the bridegroom who pursue each other in the desire to unite in a love that is inexpressible and can only really reach fulfillment in religious terms. That becomes the image that is used to explain, to understand, and to characterize the desire for the religious to live their vow.
And isn't Claire actually invoking the Song of Songs?
Yes.
When she refers to Christ as spouse and
yes.
lover?
Yes, throughout her letters, in all of her letters, she uses the imagery of Christ as her spouse, as her beloved bridegroom. She imagines herself seated with him where he places his arm around her shoulder, which of course is based on the image in the Song of Songs of the bridegroom bringing his bride towards him by placing his arm around her. It's the physical, it's the caressing, it's the relational. And it's a relationship. We tend to think now that religious men and women, when they thought about their vocations and their bodies, that somehow it was rather abstract. It was life-denying. It was disembodied. But in fact, I think when you read Claire's letters, when you read the sense of the bodily, of experience taking place in their bodies, then you realise how deeply the experience, how deeply their imagery is based on incarnation.
I think today it's inescapable to read those letters and not think of this as being quite erotic, a kind of sublimated eroticism, which is transformed into a holy love.
Oh, I think it's absolutely erotic. I don't know whether I would go so far as to talk of it being sublimated only because I think that's a term that we inherit from the late 19th century, from the great work of Freud and the understanding of the unconscious.
So how would you explain it?
I think it was something that was based on an understanding of sexuality and a sense of the body containing memories, the body being something that was truly a gift from God and that was understood in a much deeper and a fuller way than perhaps we are able to understand in our post-Freudian age.
Do you think this is a Franciscan view of the body and love of Christ?
I wouldn't say it was limited to the Franciscans, but I think Francis, especially when we think of the fact that his ultimate experience of identification with Christ was through the stigmata, and of course that's an experience that is above all literally a body encapsulating the experience, then perhaps the Franciscans and Claire, perhaps they most powerfully capture that sense of the body as a vehicle to express the search for the sublime.
Can I ask you finally, how far did Claire's influence radiate?
Literally throughout the world. Within her own lifetime, her influence, her way of life, her pursuit of poverty and her imitation of Christ had attracted women not only in Italy but in as far away as Prague, where her message was not only seized on by middle-class women but, of course, by Agnes of Prague, who was a member of the royal family. Women joined her movement in Germany, in England, of course, in Spain. So it was perhaps not, they didn't attract the numbers, of course, that Francis did, but they were certainly a wide, wide geographic influence.
And was it a lay order?
And there also were women who were attracted to Claire and her way of life in what we call the Third Order. That was the most important part of the Franciscan and Poor Claire movement. Yes.
The lay third order tertiary.
Of tertiaries, exactly. That's right. And in some ways, I think the tertiaries in some ways were more important in actually disseminating the ideals of the Poor Clares than perhaps the Poor Clares were themselves in some ways.
Well, Claire Rankine, Constant Muse, I think this book is going to have a great deal of popularity. Thank you so much for illuminating the Franciscan legacy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
The book is Interpreting Francis and Claire of Assisi from the Middle Ages to the Present, edited by Constant Muse and Claire Rankine, with contributions from an array of international specialists and with great illustrations of the art which we've just been talking about. One of the artworks produced by Franciscans, a diptych by Pietro Tutonico, hangs in the National Gallery of Victoria. Unfortunately, the day I was in Melbourne to speak to Hugh Hudson, who's made a special study of it, the gallery was closed. So in the park, across the street, with the book's illustration in front of us, Hugh began by explaining what is a diptych.
Well, a diptych is a work of art in two pieces, and in this case it's two pieces of wood encasing two pieces of glass. It's in a technique called verre églomisé, the golden glass. It's produced by painting gold leaf onto a pane of glass and then etching the design onto the back of that gold leaf and then painting over the voided areas. So once the glass is turned over, that's preserved forever.
Well, the artist, Pietro Tutonico, sounds like he must be German.
Correct.
St. Francis seems to have had quite a few admirers in German lands.
There's not very much that's known about the early artists who came, but we can assume that there would have been many that travelled from across north of the Alps to Italy, partly because the cult of St. Francis was so important at this time. And there are traces of evidence that even major artists, such as Jan van Eyck from the 15th century, would have come on a pilgrimages through Rome, sometimes further on to the east, and would have stopped at the major pilgrimage sites associated with St. Francis's life, and in particular where he was buried in Assisi.
Well, Pietro was very interested in St. Francis, but especially in his miracles.
Indeed, he's actually, for many centuries, he was better known as a writer than as an artist or craftsman, and that's because he compiled lists of St. Francis's posthumous miracles, and we know those from three extant manuscripts.
Well, that would have helped in his other interest, which was in the making of reliquaries.
Indeed, and this reliquary, as well as a number of others which are very similar in style in other museums around the world, actually contain what purport to be relics of St. Francis, as well as images of the saint. So in this particular instance, we have the earliest image of St. Francis, in fact, in any Australian collection, dating from the early 14th century, as well as tiny fragments which purport to be, and if you read the Latin inscription, it says, of the flesh of St. Francis's foot and part of his tunic.
Goodness, well, I suppose we all know there was quite a heavy trade in relics. Are there other relics included in this diptych?
Indeed, there are a great many relics included in this diptych, notably of St. Clair, who, of course, is very closely associated with St. Francis. In the Latin inscription, it tells us there is part of her veil, part of her hair, and part of her tunic. And in addition, we have a who's who of medieval Christianity, everyone from the Virgin Mary herself, the True Cross, fragments of the True Cross, Christ's Sepulchre, and then around 40 or so saints, including everybody from Vincent to Blaise, the evangelists, Helen of Constantinople, and the list goes on.
And I think there's a piece of Jesus' tunic.
That's correct. We have here at the top of the right-hand element of the diptych, I think it's three or four fragments, relics of Christ. We have the wood of the True Cross. We have part of the Mensa Christi, which was the table where the risen Christ met the apostles, and, as you say, part of his tunic.
Well, this actually depicts the birth of Jesus on the one hand, on the left side, and his crucifixion on the right. But Francis managed to get a cameo appearance in these depictions.
Well, that's true, and it's very much in line with his personal approach to the role of art in devotion. In his own lifetime, he was in favour and inspired by religious art. There's the famous episode of his life as told by St. Bonaventura, that he recognized his calling when praying before a crucifix. And when you go to Assisi and you see the mural paintings in the basilica, he appears twice in the church at crucifixion scenes, and it's very closely associated with the crucifixion. But also, of course, with the nativity, because he was one of the first to promote the Christmas nativity scene for children.
That's pretty important, and that's certainly a legacy that's become way more popular than he would have ever imagined. But with all of these relics in this diptych, one would imagine that the owner of it was very wealthy indeed.
That is something that you would assume indeed, because of the precious aspect of the materials and technique, the lavish use of gold leaf, for example, and the high level of technical expertise that would be required to produce an object such as this. But on the other hand, we also have to remember that there were probably a large number of similar relics that were produced in the workshop by the Franciscan friars themselves at Assisi, where this diptych is believed to have come from. And that was presumably because they were producing these for the pilgrims as mementos of their trip to Assisi. So they would have visual reminders of St. Francis, and also reminders of the pilgrimage itself.
Who was the commissioner of this diptych?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and until now it would have been assumed that there wasn't one, that probably these were produced on speculation for the market, for the visiting pilgrims. However, this particular diptych is a little bit different because it has two coats of arms on the frame. During my research for this article in the book, I was able to identify the arms on the right-hand side as belonging to an Italian family from Florence, in fact, whose name are the Scalini. And the Scalini means, in Italian, ladder. And indeed, there is a picture of a ladder on the coat of arms.
So is much known about them?
What we do know is that the coat of arms is found in Florence in the 14th and 15th century, that they lived in a particular part of Florence called Santa Maria Novella, which is in the western suburbs of Florence, We don't know a great deal more about them apart from that, presumably because they weren't very prominent in government, but prominent enough to have a coat of arms.
And when does this diptych originate?
We'd have to assume that this was probably made in the 1320s, because there's a representation of St. Louis of Toulouse, and he was canonized, from memory, if I'm correct, in 1317. So the fact that in this diptych he is represented with a halo as a saint would suggest to us that it postdates his canonization.
So when did it come into the possession of the National Gallery of Victoria? And was Pietro Teutonico so well known that this would have been a much coveted piece?
Not at all. Pietro Teutonico has been one of many obscure artists of the Middle Ages, and he was rescued from general ignorance, you could say, by Italian art historians who studied very carefully the documents of the archives in Assisi and came across a reference to someone who donated works of art in this technique of ver eglomise to a number of Franciscan houses at that time, and some of those objects still exist and have been identified in Assisi, and that's why we can associate the name with these kinds of objects.
And the National Gallery of Victoria acquired this piece?
They purchased it from a famous collection of classical and medieval artefacts, that the Oppenheimer sale in London in the 1930s, and it was purchased from the Felton Bequest, which was a bequest given in part to the National Gallery of Victoria to grow its collection. At the same sale, they also purchased a very beautiful Virgin and Child drawing by Albrecht Dürer.
So as a scholar of Franciscan theology and history, what would be the great value of this piece from that perspective?
Unlike present day, where we tend to be more removed from emotional or devotional experiences connected with art, in the medieval period, people responded directly to images with faith. And obviously an article such as this, with its relics, which to a modern mind might seem almost incredible, including relics of the True Cross and Christ's tunic, but in the medieval period, perhaps it wasn't a question of is it or isn't it, but what does it signify? So what is the idea behind these relics?
So what you're also pointing to here is that people didn't just rely on going to the church to have that experience of worship and devotion. This was a piece that was used in the domestic setting, at home.
Absolutely, and we know from medieval and Renaissance inventories of household objects that families had relics saints, and the more prosperous families would have them decorated with gold work and silver work and in expensive settings such as this diptych.
Well, Hugh, it's been wonderful talking to you out here in Alexandra Park in Melbourne, a beautiful place, and it's a beautiful setting for what is a very gorgeous little gem.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And you can see the diptych yourself at the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne. Hugh Hudson is a research assistant and honorary research fellow in art history at the University of Melbourne. Of course, the life of St. Francis has inspired a great deal of artwork, including Arthur Boyd's magnificent tapestry series held by the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra. And by the way, if you're vegetarian, St. Francis is featured in a book, Vegetarian Christian Saints, by Dr. Holly Roberts. Wonder if Claire is in it. That's our program. Details of my guests and the book, as well as music, will be on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. Production was by me and Jeff Wood. Next week is a chance to take stock of your life. Are you really living in a way that brings you happiness, peace of mind, and joy? It's all up to you. But the Indian spiritual teacher Master Berengista and others are on hand to give you some sage advice. Don't miss it. The Spirit of Things next week with me, Rachel Conn.